to open the Senate Education General Government Committee. And today is one of those general government days, with the exception of this short but important piece of business we have to do first. And so I open a work session on Senate Bill 44. Colleagues, you know this as the kindergarten compromise, and we have one new amendment which adds some technical language. Dana, if you could go over that in brief and let us know what that change was.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the Dash 7 amendments that are before the committee today do extend the status quo, as it were, through 2011-2012. They also establish a full-day kindergarten implementation committee to advise the legislature and school districts on public charter schools on providing full-day kindergarten by the year 2012 to the school year 2012 to 2013. It specifies what the committee would provide technical expertise on, and it goes through the committee membership. The difference between this and the Dash 6s is that the committee will meet at the call of the superintendent rather than the call of the chair of the committee. And then it sunsets that committee at the beginning of the 2011 legislative session. We've got fiscal and revenue statements here as well. There's no revenue impact. The Dash 7 fiscal impact statement indicates that the department had is fine. There's no additional cost to extend the status quo. It indicates that the fiscal impact for school districts and public charter schools is indeterminate, and that the cost of establishing the committee and going forward with that work would be absorbed within the Department of Education.
Okay, and just to reiterate and clarify one point on the capital needs, it's not our intention in this legislation to have the department do an entire capital needs capacity study, as much as it is only to the extent that it relates to full day kindergarten. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 44.
Senator Morse moves to adopt the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 44. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had this discussion before, but I just want to put on the record that I'll be supporting the Dash 7 amendments, but I also want to make clear that I have the same concerns about it that I did when I voted no on the tuition for public kindergarten bill in 2008. We really need to try hard as a body to find a way so that we aren't charging families tuition for public education. But I understand that in these economic times with the constraints we have, this is something that we need to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none. If not, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 44 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 44 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for your willingness to accommodate concerns on this. I think we have now put us on a path with a specific destination, and we will get there. You have my commitment on that. We've had that discussion, and I just really appreciate your willingness to address the concerns in this issue.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will echo what Senator Cruz has just said, and for your hard work and dedication, continuous dedication to this issue. I'm glad that there will be some legislators involved in an advisory capacity on this work, and would just hope that after all the good work is done, that on the recommendations for funding isn't just give us more money and we'll be able to do it, otherwise we can't. I mean, it has to be done within the scope of whatever the realities of our educational dollars. How do we then, whatever that may be at that time, how do we direct those dollars to meet whatever the goals of that are established in the legislation and our goals as a committee and as a state for full-day kindergarten? I think that's, you know, really, really important as part of being able to take that next step and actually getting that work done. So thank you for your work on this, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Senator Metzger. Well said to your point. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Measure passes. The motion passes. I will carry this on the floor.
All right.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 44 and open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 187.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 187 increases the amount below which the Department of Agriculture may refuse to issue payment refunds.
Okay, we have a couple of people signed up for this.
Chair Haas, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lauren Henderson, our Assistant Director that oversees our administrative services portion of our agency. The Oregon Department of Agriculture issues between 40 and 45,000 licenses and registrations annually. The law that we are looking to amend allows the Department of Agriculture specifically to provide refunds to individuals for certain circumstances. In that law, it also allows for refunds not to be issued automatically at a certain threshold. That threshold currently is $5. ODA is proposing to increase the threshold for which it would not automatically issue a refund to $25. We do, however, by policy, anytime an individual has overpaid fees and requests that in writing, we will provide a refund for those fees. In the testimony for Senate Bill 187, we did a simple calculation to give you an idea of what the magnitude of this work is currently within the department. We estimate it takes about an hour of total staff time for all the handling and processing of paper to do one of these refunds. There are about 500 of them a biennium. And during the previous biennium, the total dollars that would have been affected if the threshold of $25 was in place would have been $6,745. We estimate the time in processing these refunds to be about $15,700. And the estimated hourly cost to produce one of these refunds is about $31. And so we see this as an efficiency measure that would allow us to free up time and reallocate that to processing licenses and other things in a more rapid fashion. And that's a quick summary of what this bill does. It's very agency specific.
Yes, it looks like it. Someone pays a fee for, can you give me a hypothetical in which this would...
Sure, Chair Haas. For the record, again, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director of the Department of Ag. Unfortunately, we have a pretty diverse number of licenses. It's not, I register one item times $5. Many of our licenses are very complex. People may have to have a base charge and then get an assessment based on gross sales and value. And so some of those calculations can be very difficult for some people. This would go in play if someone maybe didn't follow the directions very well and our form sent in dollars or sent in dollars for a previous year and those kinds of things. And we get a lot of $5, $6 overpayments. That's included in part of this 500. So that's a typical case. Certainly, if our staff make a mistake, this does not apply. We send them back if we've told them something and they made an error in that. This is just refunds that are overpayments that come to us that are caused by their misunderstanding of their business or how they've done, and then the processing of that. I do just to add a little bit. Along with this, we felt it was necessary not to just do this. I have asked our staff, and they're almost done, to make sure that our license instructions and forms have been totally redone. We used some user groups in some of the industries to say, what would make it easier for you guys to do some of these calculations? So our new licensing forms are a little easier to read. They're longer now, but they provide a template for people to do a worksheet so that they can try to get it right. Our goal is to get the number of these down. We don't want to do them, but we really need the staff time back because at our peak periods with that volume of licensing, it can take 2 to 4 weeks to get someone a license, and we'd like to get those out the door a little bit quicker.
Questions from agricultural interests represented in this committee?
Mr. Chair, I'm just disappointed that you aren't requiring Katie to come up and testify, but other than that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there ever an instance where the department calculates the amount due?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Morris. Sure, if they call, we can try to help them on the phone, try to get the right number for them. I think some of our field staff will go out and maybe help if they're new to try to get them through what they need to get licensed. In that regard, our folks would maybe assist them with what they would owe as a license fee.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for this question because I'm not in any way reflecting on the department, but if the department is calculating the fee, there's a potential to add another $20 to a complicated schedule as a fee increase. And that was behind my question.
Yeah.
No way am I casting dispersions upon the department, but that was behind the question.
Chair Haas and Vice Chair Morse, that's actually a good question. We have pretty good separation and controls in our agency. For that to happen, it would go through two or three steps, and I would like to think that someone in our agency would catch that and go, this isn't right. And if we caught that and saw that, we would certainly issue those funds back. We have a good number of staff, and I'd like to think that would never happen. But I do want to add one other thing. How did we get $25? Currently in statute in other agencies, Department of Consumer Business Services, Health Licensing, I think the Construction Contractors Board, they have limits that are $20, $25, somewhere in that range.
And certainly not saying in this legislation that if someone makes an error themselves and it's not owed $20, you're not going to say, let's just give them the money anyway. It's cheaper to do that.
Chair Haas, I'm not sure I understood your question.
If the error is the person who is claiming a refund, you're not saying it's just easier to just pay that refund, even if it's not so.
This legislation, if they did not ask for it in writing, we would not automatically give them back that $20. We will certainly talk to folks about and maybe even promulgate rules. We don't have rules in this particular number to talk to people so they know what our process is. So it's very clear that if they ask for it in writing, that we would then issue it back, even if it's a dollar. Frankly, I think we've done that before.
Okay. Other questions on this? Well, you're the only two people signed up to testify. And if it's the will of the committee to move forward, Senator Morris.
Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 187 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 187 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I just have one question.
Senator Morris.
Senator Metzger.
Just as a point for as we move forward to the floor on this, it would be helpful if the department would provide a brief one-page something about the steps they are taking so that their forms are more easily understood, thus reducing the amount of overpayment, because I think that question may come up, and I think it would be helpful for members to say, well, yeah, you know, gee, we have complicated forms, we get a lot of refunds, and now we're not going to pay them back. It'd be easy to say that we recognize that, and as you testified, but also give us some indication of how that's being done so that members would feel more comfortable with it. That's all.
We'll be happy to take that.
Appreciate that.
And Mr. Chair, I believe we passed a plain language requirement in 2007.
What does that mean?
A plain calculation amendment we need now.
Yeah. Define plain language.
Yeah. Further discussion, seeing none. Any objections to moving this bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation? Seeing none. So moved, so adopted. Let's see, an efficiency measure for the Agriculture Department.
I wonder who's going to get this one.
Senator Cruz, would you be so kind?
I love that one.
All right. close a work session public hearing on 187 and open a public hearing on SJR 4. And we have a couple people lined up here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 4 authorizes a person serving as a judge to be employed by the State Board of Higher Education or a school board. It would refer a proposed amendment to people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general election. It does have a subsequent referral to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Margie Parrish, and with me here today is the Honorable Carsten Rasmussen from the Circuit Court of Lane County. I'm the Dean of the University of Oregon School of Law. I speak in support of Senate Joint Resolution 4, which amends the Oregon Constitution to allow judges to teach in public institutions of higher education. Currently, both of the private law schools in this state use judges from time to time as adjunct professors, teaching a course in the evenings or on the weekends. For example, Kathy Graham, who is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Willamette University Law School, with whom I spoke today, told me that they use from time to time justices on the Oregon Supreme Court, the Oregon Court of Appeals, and so on, to teach classes for them. And the website of the Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland indicates also that they have circuit court members of the bench teach for them. And obviously, these courses greatly enrich the experience of the law students in those schools. This is a practice that's followed across the country. Law schools, of course, follow the same practice with legislators, asking them to teach from time to time in the evenings or on weekends. Currently, the Oregon Constitution does not permit judges to teach in public institutions of higher education. Article 3 of the Oregon Constitution has a strict separation of powers provision that states that no member of one branch of government can perform the functions of another branch unless the Constitution explicitly says otherwise. Technically, institutions of higher education in this state are part of the executive branch. So a member of the judiciary who teaches a course in a law school might be construed as performing the functions of a member of the executive branch during that teaching. The same provision would be violated if a member of the legislative branch were to teach in a public law school, but the provision in Article 3 has been amended for legislators to permit them to teach. However, it has never been amended to permit judges to teach. And as dean of the state's only public law school, I can tell you that we're adversely affected by this provision. I should say, rather, that our students are adversely affected by this provision because we'd very much like to be able to offer them the benefit of having a judge teach a course for them in the evenings or on the weekends, just as our private sister law schools do. So judges can't teach for us, probably even if they are volunteering their services. The constitutional provision, although it doesn't state, it probably applies in this situation whether the judges are being paid or not. There is some confusion here, which was created by the Sawyer case. That was a case that involved a judge who was teaching for pay at Southern Oregon University. And in Sawyer, the Supreme Court of Oregon stated that Article 3 of the Oregon Constitution applied in that situation to prohibit him from teaching in that public institution. As I mentioned, it's unclear whether this provision would apply in a situation in which a judge were volunteering his or her time as opposed to being paid, but there's sufficient confusion about it that judges, for the most part, don't want to risk being seen as violating the provision. This measure, SJR 4, would change the Constitution to clarify, in the same way that legislators can teach in the classroom, judges may teach as well if that classroom is in a public institution. And so this change would allow us to offer the same kind of enrichment to our students as offered by Willamette and Lewis and Clark Law Schools. I can't see any good reason not to make the change. First of all, this is a revenue-neutral measure. Second of all, teaching is not a policy-making matter, and judges who teach would be doing so as a very part-time basis, so there wouldn't be any inherent conflict of interest. And finally, I would doubt certainly that the change could affect judicial productivity at all. We're talking about courses that a judge might teach, as I mentioned, in the evenings or on the weekends. So judges wouldn't be full-time members of our faculty or even regular part-time members. This bill simply enables our public law school students to have the same kind of enrichment as private school students do, and I urge you to support it. Thank you. And I'll be happy to provide my testimony in paper, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that. Questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair. Not that I would have an objection, but this would also allow, for example, a circuit court judge to teach a class in a public school as well, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I believe that's correct.
Which would be fine with me as well.
Yes.
So, well, you know, they could teach civics, they could do all sorts of good things in a public school, and I see no problem with bringing people into the classroom that have expertise in the real world. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's just one slight problem, Senator Cruz.
Yes.
They'd have to be certified by the TSPC.
To be employed, you're correct. They would be, yes.
Teacher Standards and Practice Commission.
Yeah. A glitch in the system, but...
Judge, did you want to testify in this?
Mr. Chairman, Karsten Rasmussen, Circuit Court Judge, Lane County, former member of the State Senate, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions you have, except I'd appreciate it if you would not allow Senator Bonamici to ask me any questions, since we went to law school together. And the question she wants to ask me is, what in the world would you have to offer to teach anybody? But I don't, knowing the senator, I don't doubt that she might share that with you later anyway. I'm very happy to answer any questions. There are, of course, some interesting sideline questions with respect to teacher standards, although there are some community college and other university courses that don't apply to Senator Morse's comment that would be assumedly available to a judge. You know, the idea here really isn't whether someone's going to be paid or not. It's that this case of N. Ray Sawyer creates some confusion. It creates some questions about where the line is. I know from personal experience of a couple of colleagues of mine who one year decided to teach a class in insurance law at the University of Oregon Law School, and the following year decided maybe not. I'm not sure if this is where the line is here, and we're really asking for your help to make that line a little finer. Of course, it requires a vote of the people because it's a change to the Constitution, and that's what we're asking for, and I have no idea what the people will say on the topic, and I can tell you that there is no union for judges, so there won't be a big campaign effort here, although, you know, I've seen Mark Nelson wandering around, so maybe I'll talk with him. But I would appreciate your support and be very happy to answer any questions you have, and I appreciate your time here today.
The existing language, was that added to the Constitution?
The existing language about teachers, which is the exception, was added to the Constitution in, I think, 1958. And, in fact, the language that you have in front of you, which I dug around and found, is, in fact, virtually the same as the language adopted to make the exception for teachers, which would allow you to teach at a community college or lecture at a law school. And in fact, when I was just starting the practice of law, one of my predecessors and your predecessors in the state senate taught a class at the law school. And so, and that was permitted by this exception that's been written into the Constitution.
The original prohibition, though, was that part of the original Constitution? Was that added somewhere after statehood?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly how old that is, but it is old.
Mm-hmm. And the idea was these rascally judges would somehow influence the other branch of government unduly?
I think it's this pure separation of powers concern, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if they were worried more about me or you, but...
I'm not going there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Dean and Judge.
Thank you.
I guess I'm a little surprised that this hasn't come up before. If you're saying that the decision was in 1979, which was, of course, before the judge and I even started law school, I'm surprised that it hasn't been brought forward. It reminds me of the similar constitutional amendment that the Grant High School students brought to us in 07 to change the requirement that you have to be 21 to vote on school board elections, and that was brought to us by a Grant High School constitutional team. I guess I'll ask either of you, would this prohibit a federal court judge from teaching?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Dean, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, I don't think there's any restrictions right now on what a federal judge does. In fact, there are a number of federal judges who teach at law schools, right, both public and private, in Oregon because, of course, the Oregon Constitution doesn't apply to them. I think the answer to your earlier question is that the truth is that judges as a group are a very, very cautious bunch, and that's probably why you haven't seen it before. This has been discussed for years, and most people don't want to most of us don't really want to be sitting here in front of a legislative committee talking about this. You know, I've been doing a volunteer teaching course at the law school with another professor, co-teaching, guest lecturing. You know, it's not quite clear where that line is, and every year I think to myself, am I doing something I shouldn't do? And I've concluded I'm not, but I don't like thinking about it every year when it seems like an easy fix, and it seems like such a non-issue. From the standpoint of conflicts, you know, I deal with conflicts every single day. A classmate of mine from high school in Junction City had a case, was assigned to me, and that case went down the hallway to another judge because I'm not going to hear that. And just as if something came up with the U of O Law School or even the U of O and one of us were guest lecturing over there, well, then the case would go down the hall to another judge. So there's a whole mechanism now in place from an ethical standpoint that would deal with any of those problems, as well as our first and foremost obligation, which is to the bench and to the people who elect us to the bench. And so I think some of those things have become clarified in the last couple of decades, and I don't know why it hasn't come up before now, except I just decided I'd give it a whirl this year and talk with Senator Przanski, and he said he thought it was a good idea.
And just a brief follow-up?
Sure.
And what are you teaching, Judge?
Oregon Practice and Procedure Center.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your stamina to go forward here, because there's miles to go before you sleep on this. I don't see anybody from the executive branch here who might want to weigh in.
Well, that makes it 2-1, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I believe I'm from the executive branch.
Well, that's
true. That's good.
I think we'd be inclined to move this bill forward. We have a new rule here, since you were here, that we need to get a statement from the fiscal department that says this has minimal or less cost to the state. And we think we're going to be getting one of those in the very near term, like within 20 minutes or half an hour. So if it's committee willing, I'd like to go to our other bill that we have remaining and possibly revisit this and pass it then.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Chairman.
Thank you very much. Committee.
All right, close hearing on SJR 4 and open a public hearing on SB 179.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SB 179 exempts records relating to a decedent that are obtained by the Department of State lands in the course of administering a decedent's estate or identifying or locating a decedent's heir or devisee.
It exempts
these records from the public records law. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage.
Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pamela Constantopoulos. I'm the estate administrator for the Department of State Lands. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 179, one of our department's bills. Senate Bill 179 is designed to be a consumer protection bill that seeks to protect the assets of an estate and the interests of potential heirs by exempting the estate's documents from Oregon public records law while the estate is under active administration of the Department of State Lands. The department administers the estates of those people who pass away without a will and without heirs. Under current law, because it is a public agency that's performing the administration of these estates, sensitive documents relating to the estate may be available to the public under public records law. Having personal information and records disclosed while DSL manages an active estate case exposes the estate's assets to loss. It may also cause financial harm to legitimate heirs if an heir searcher seeking a commission locates the heir before DSL is able to complete its work. A similar estate under the administration of any private personal representative would have the same documents protected against public disclosure. This bill does several things. It proposes to do several things. First of all, it keeps all of the records from estates under DSL's active administration confidential until the work is completed. It does not exempt the probate filings in the court. This extends the current protection realized by privately held estates to those under our administration. In addition, this bill protects potential heirs from paying unnecessary fees to heir searchers before DSL is able to complete the search. It does not limit the heir searcher's ability to access information that's currently available in publicly filed probate documents. It maintains the same standard of disclosure as they enjoy with privately administered estates. Finally, this bill seeks to protect the estates from loss through identity theft and related illegal financial transactions. Earlier this week, I had the privilege of meeting with Mr. Tom Gallagher, who is beside me, and he expressed concern over the placement of this language in the public records law. I would request the permission of the chair and this committee to work with legislative counsel to and Mr. Gallagher to move the language into ORS 113, which is our governing statute that gives state lands the authority to act on no will, no heir cases. And thank you, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. So it would be your wishes or desires or acquiescence to move to the non-public record statute. Can you explain to me that?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, yes, we would be fine with moving that to our governing statutes. And it would also parallel with a similar provision that we have in our unclaimed property statutes.
Can you give us an example, a hypothetical, these sensitive properties, sensitive assets that you're talking about, and what are the trade-offs that we'd be asked to make policy?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, when staff goes out to an estate, we collect any and all sorts of information that we might be able to use in order to locate a legitimate heir. It may be everything from a World War II love letter to family Bibles to Christmas cards, anything you can imagine. And we have had incidences in the past where, because we are a public agency, we're asked to open up our entire file just because we are in possession of that file. And hence is our request to exempt that from disclosure to permit us at least the time to administer the estate and to complete our work before it's opened up to everybody.
So what is the, I mean, there's a problem then, you open up your file and air searchers go to work, or what is the problem we're being asked to solve?
Chair, as members of the committee, we are requesting that we basically have the ability to administer the estate and to check all of our leads for heirs before it's made totally public. So one of our main goals in administering the estate is to try and find the legitimate heirs, and we use any number of resources to attempt to do that. We do extensive searches, including internationally. We do find heirs in about a third of our estates every year, but opening it up prematurely would cause an heir potentially to have to pay money that's unnecessary because they would get it for free, basically.
Questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. First of all, I appreciate your discussion point of moving this request to the other statute. I mean, Mr. Chair, I just public records, I just always vote against those. Yeah. Just the way it is. So I appreciate that. Second thing is, and I know we got attorneys in the room. This is wonderful. But I did receive one letter and I about this issue, and not being one, if you could help explain this more. You say in your testimony it does not limit searchers' ability to access information currently available in publicly filed probate documents. So I don't know what publicly, privately, I don't understand what, is that a different type of probate? And this one was from a private investigator who said that it will exempt certain probate filings and they're designed to be public information, so liens against the estate are aware of available assets. Is that accurate, that plea, or is your testimony say that is not?
Chair Haas, members of the Senator Metzger, it is our intent that any of the documents that are filed in the court are still public documents and readily accessible to anybody. I do believe, after talking with Mr. Gallagher, that we may need to put a little bit more definition into the language of the bill when we move it, that would clarify that it's only records, that the court-filed documents are not exempt. It's those records that are still held within the agency alone that's being used for the air search that would be exempt from disclosure. So in other words, in a probate filing, everything basically, such as the person's name, their address, the basic list of assets, that's all public information that's filed in the court that's still going to be available.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, just so then explain to me the stuff that you would have that would not be available now. And what you say that would still be available. What would not be available then if we pass this?
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, it would be those documents such as those Christmas cards, the love letters and stuff that have rabbit trails, as they call them, that would lead us to heirs, that would not be in publicly filed documents, that would not be open for disclosure.
But would not be documents that would be pertinent to any claims against the estate necessary for them to determine that. They would not be that category of documents.
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, that would be correct. All of that would still be available.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Other questions, Senator Cruz?
Yeah. I'm trying to get my hands around this, Mr. Chair. So these documents that you're wanting to sequester, ordinarily, how long would they be sequestered?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, they would only be sequestered during the period in time in which we have an active probate filing. So that would be until probate is closed, in which case the case would escheat, and at that time it would be public record.
Is there time? Okay, that didn't give me a time frame.
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, if I may, in a state is like a dog's tail. Some of them may be closed very quickly. Others may take several years to complete.
So if I could. So if you are, could I assume that when you're doing an active search, it's still everything's still sequestered when you've done all your due diligence? Is that the point where it's no longer sequestered, or?
Chair Haas, Senator.
I'm trying to figure out your process. I realize some are going to be long and some are going to be short, but what factors are the determinant factors in the time frame you set for your process?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, I would define the active administration as the term in which there is an active probate case open on the estate. So when that case is final in the court, that is when it becomes an escheat property, and that would then be open for disclosure.
Okay,
that's a good point.
That is a good point, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just wondering why. I mean, clearly finding potential errors is a key element of this, I would assume. I'm just wondering why we're limiting the opportunity for that to happen. But, I mean, the state has resources, but there are the resources available to do searches. And I would think that one of the things we want to do is have resolution, and finding errors is a relatively quick way to resolution, I would think. But.
Chair Huss, Senator Cruz, there are good people out there looking for information on the estates, and there are bad. And we see on nearly a monthly basis people who are trying to raid the estates who have no legitimate claim to it. And any one of those people who are acting illegitimately could potentially file a public records request. And as a public agency, without this clarification that we're asking, we would be required to turn it over. Obviously, we would have great concern over doing that. And the other side is what we would like is the opportunity to find those heirs. And in essence, we're saving them paying 30 or 50% in many cases, which is what a heir searcher might charge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm going to need to see a new version of this, because the way I see it now is that currently they're public records. The bill as written says that it's an exemption to the public records. And the way I understand your testimony is that if you put it in another part of the statute, you can keep them confidential. But I don't understand how moving them to another part of the statute makes them so that they're not public records. You're still a public entity, and there's still records that are in your possession, so I'm just having trouble seeing why moving the exemption to another part of the statute makes them not discoverable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. Let me just walk you quickly through that. If you turn to the bill on page 2, you'd see on line 18, subsection 9A, and subsection 9. And what it says there, public records or information which is prohibited or restricted or otherwise made confidential or privileged under Oregon law is exempt now under 192.502. So if they put that language in another section of the statute, it's bootstrapped into the public to the confidentiality through subsection 9. That's how that would work.
Thank you.
Okay, well, stand by if you could. We have some other people who want to testify here. Matt Marquis.
I have my own testimony.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, I didn't know if you were.
Am I a potted plant?
We just thought you were standing by in case expertise is needed. And
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, the last thing I'm is helpful. I'd like to take you for a second here and talk about how the newspaper publishers get involved in this. We are self-appointed guardians of the public record. This public record law in Oregon has been around since 1973, and we have two principles. We don't think records should be exempt, period, but we can be persuaded that it's an overarching public policy that says that there's a reason for keeping these records exempt. In this case, and I talked to the department, I was unable to determine, you know, in my own judgment, what the public policy was here, so I made the suggestion that they moved this back into another part of the statute. The reason for that is they would be exempt for a period of time and then they would become available. So they're not permanently exempt. Section 192 is divided into two parts, 501 and 502. Section 501 are exempt public records that can be released subject to the public interest. Section 502 is an absolute prohibition. You can't release a public record. In this case, well, the suggestion was they move it back into their Section 113, which would say to them they would hold this record exempt from disclosure for a period of time until the estate went through the sale. That could be a number of years. And then all of those records would be available. The one piece of information that I don't understand yet, and it's my fault for not having asked it, Pamela's, is that the probate process and the court process would open up part of the public records but not other parts of the estate. And here's where I don't understand the public policy piece of this. If a very famous person died intestate and their property became abandoned and these letters were like the letters of the Brownings, very important historical records, literary records, etc., I don't know whether they would be available in time for the public to look at, for researchers to look at, et cetera. I can understand this in lots of little cases where it's just somebody, normal person like us, who dies, and part of their record would be forever buried. I think this is, you know, I don't have the wherewithal to go through this piece of the analysis here. So that from the newspaper publishers, we would be comfortable, if you're satisfied with the public policy, that the solution that we've suggested works fairly well for temporarily holding the records confidential. And it would be bootstrapped in through subsection 9 of 192.502 as an exempt record. But that's the end of my testimony.
Questions?
Thank you. Mr. Markey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing Brandenburger and Davis, which is an air locating company that on occasion does ask for records such as these from the Division of State Lands. We are testifying in opposition to the bill. We feel air locating companies are legitimate companies that serve a purpose here in Oregon and across the nation in finding relatives of people that have died without a will. I feel that competition in this situation, at the very least, even to motivate the Division of State Lands and finding somebody, it can't be a bad thing. I mean, right now, without that competition or without that motivation, it's hard to say what their motivation is in finding somebody directly. They said that they find one-third of all of a relative in one-third of all their cases, but if records are held until after probate is closed, that means that 66% of these cases they don't find anybody in. And during the probate process, most of these assets would all be liquidated. And if you can find a relative prior to that, that is a good thing. There may be a relative that doesn't want these assets liquidated, whether it's a stock or it's some sort of family heirloom or some situation like that. The other thing that is important to think of is that if you can find a relative even before probate is filed, again, that's a good thing. There may be a relative that may want to file their own probate and go through that process themselves rather than having the Division of State Lands be their personal representative in that case. This bill is about the records. I think you heard in the testimony prior to this that, you know, air locating companies charge these outrageous fees. I would say that the fees that were mentioned are more than most air locating companies would ever charge, more than the one that we represent, definitely. There's a separate bill dealing with fees to air locating companies in the Senate Judiciary Committee right now, introduced by the state bar, of all people, to limit contingency fees on air locating companies. interestingly enough, three out of the past four sessions, there's been bills dealing with air locating companies on fees charged. There was even a bill sponsored, or at least supported by the Division of State Lands, that would have put the state ahead of first cousins in the stream of when somebody has access to money when there's a death without a will. We feel this goes a little overboard in their ask. If there really is an issue with identity theft or something like that, we feel that a better answer to this would be to have some sort of legitimate business exemption, so that maybe a licensed private investigator or law enforcement, for instance, or even the newspaper publishers, if that's what the committee deems, has access to these records prior, but that the average citizen wouldn't. I mean, if identity theft is really an issue. Interestingly enough, I haven't talked with Pamela from the Division of State Lands. I did speak with a woman by the name of Cindy, and I apologize, I forgot her last name. I asked her how many folks are getting these records, and they didn't know at that time and wasn't even sure that anybody had asked in the recent time. So I'm not even sure what problem we're trying to solve here. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions?
Well, here's one for you. How do they assess fees? I mean, I can understand historical documents having some value, but what if it is a love letter?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as far as the fees that, an air locating company would charge on something, is that what you're, you know, I think there's a variety of things. I think you have to put into play or at least remember that there are a lot of situations where even an air locating company may not find somebody and they're expending a lot of money. So their fees are going to be based on a lot of variables in that situation. I don't know what the average would be. I would guess maybe for our company in the range of maybe 15% to 20%, but I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to get back to you on that. But I will tell you that even a love letter or something like that may be a lead, as was mentioned with the previous witness, that in locating somebody. I mean, maybe there's something mentioned in that letter that, talks about a relative or something like that would, lead you in the direction of finding somebody that would be entitled to that portions of that estate.
Gotcha. Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 179. And open a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 4. Colleagues, we do not have the fiscal report back yet, but seeing how this bill has a subsequent referral to the Rules Committee, we're ruling that that's not necessary. To do that, we have to suspend our rules. And we need a unanimous consent to do that. So, do we need a motion to suspend rules, Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend rules for the purpose of moving SJR 4.
Senator Morris moves that we suspend our rules for the purpose of moving SJR 4. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 4 to the floor with a recommendation that it be
rules.
The rule.
Excuse me.
Oh, to the floor.
We have a motion.
Read the motion.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm just following directions here. Okay, we'll start over. Mr. Chair, I move SJR 4 to the floor with a recommendation that it be adopted and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules by prior reference.
Senator Morris moves Senate Joint Resolution 4 to the floor with a recommendation it be adopted and it be referred to the Committee on Rules by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Morris? Aye.
Senator Bob?
Aye. The motion passes.
We have just
colleagues,
committee bill.
We have one committee bill to be introduced as a committee bill. And Monday, by the way, is the last day to do this. So.
Yay!
Mr. Chair, I'm...
Let me open up a work session for purposes of introducing committee bills. Did you want to do a summary of this one?
I can. Members of the committee, LC 3665 reduces the types of activities for which school improvement funds can be used.
Ooh. Okay.
Is that what you have, Senator?
And as you know, committee, approval of this motion means neither opposition or support.
Could you describe that again?
Yes. It reduces the types of activities for which school improvement funds can be used.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move LC 3665, dated 2/24/09, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Morris moves that LC 3665, dated 2/24/09, be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to look at the list. I'm not sure that I think this is something we need to discuss then, so I'm glad to see the bill here. We may have some issues on what is excluded.
I know that.
Okay.
Further discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill, and we are adjourned.
Sorry, Senator Cruz. I knew that Senator Morris.